Well, welcome everyone. As you know, each month we bring to you one or more webinars on a theme of interest out of the work of Anthroposophy and Mystech. Your donations allow us to bring you such events and hopefully will one day allow for Mystech to realize some goals that Rudolf Steiner placed upon us here in the West. With this webinar, we shall complete our autumn season. We'll be looking forward to January when we will have the former head of the Biodynamic Association, Robert Karp, as our guest speaker. That'll be January 21st and 28th, and at 3 p.m. Eastern Time instead of 2 p.m. Robert will focus on the spiritual destiny of North America, Uriel, and the mystery of the three occultisms. Then in February, we will have Richard Cooper. Since I will be away on a speaking tour in March, we will skip March. And in April, we've arranged for Igor Nazarov to be our guest speaker. Mystech is a not-for-profit anthroposophical organization. It intends one day to be in the position whereby it can properly support the R&D needed to realize what Rudolf Steiner called a mechanical occultism. This term means to us that humanity will learn how to integrate a machine that will be capable of responding to moral impulses of a nearby human being by means of the vibrations emanating from that human being. During these past 7 years, while in its infancy, Mystech has offered study groups, annual conferences, and webinars such as this, with the hope that the body of Mystech will grow to finally reach the critical mass needed to seriously support such research. Today's webinar, called "The House of the Word Becomes the Word," will be given by our dear friend from the UK, Andrew Wolpert. I feel like this Andrew has become one of my best friends, even though we've never met, because we share a keen interest in Renaissance art, and we'll get to share that together during my tour in the UK in March. Today, Andrew will explore the artistic metamorphosis from the first Gertianum to the foundation stone meditation. Many of us have already heard Andrew speak, either through Sue Pete's Friday webinars or through Chicago's branches webinars. Andrew has been giving courses, seminars, and lectures on languages, art history, Shakespeare, and Parzival at where I went, Emerson College, at the University in Stuttgart, and for a number of other schools and institutions in Europe, Australia, and Asia. In addition, he coordinates the humanities section of the School of Spiritual Science in Great Britain. Andrew, we are so fortunate to have you join us today, especially with this topic, as we are now just a week away from the 100th anniversary of the Christmas Conference of 1923. And the refounding of the Anthroposophical Society. So, dear Andrew, thank you for being our guest today, and over to you.
Dear Andrew, thank you for inviting me. Thank you for your very generous welcome and for introducing me as you have done. So in London, it is now shortly after 7 o'clock in the evening. So I wish you a good evening wherever you may be. I realize that you may be in other time zones, and wherever you are, welcome, dear friends. We are now in Advent, and if it is your destiny to prepare Advent for little children, then you know what a joy it is to care for their excitement and their anticipation, and the innocent joy in approaching the birth events that we commemorate and celebrate at Christmas. But if if you're an adult in that position, you may also know that this is one of the hardest times of the year. The outer challenges and the inner challenges really are trials. And in order to be able to create something of that Advent mood for the children, and my experience is that I'm sorely tested in ways that belong to my destiny and to my connection with the world. And so it is in the spirit of endeavoring to be adequate for this time of the year, not just for the children, but for maybe also what the spiritual world is waiting for. It's in the endeavor to be adequate for that I offer you this evening my very unfinished, imperfect thoughts on this theme. The house of the word becomes the word. In preparing this presentation this evening, I went through various thoughts about what the best way of doing that would be. And I had even prepared many images to illustrate my talk. But I then decided I would like to risk not showing any images in the hope that if you can follow the way I'm speaking, the necessary imaginations may arise within you. And I'm also assuming that if you're connecting to this work this evening, that maybe the First Gaudium and the Foundation Stone Meditation are things that you already have some familiarity with. I hope if you're new to these themes, that the way I address them will enable you to follow. And perhaps also if I awaken an interest in you in these, you'll be able to find the images and the texts that I shall be referring to quite easily on the internet or in your libraries. I would like to start with the idea that I hope to end up with. And I would like to start with it so that the aim, the destination of these thoughts is visible from the beginning. So we encounter all kinds of images outside us, outside in the world, all sorts of things that Rudolf Steiner calls percepts in the philosophy of freedom. And sometimes these percepts are new things, and we have to find our way into them as something that is unfamiliar to us. But sometimes it is the case that what we perceive outside in the world actually has the task of reminding us of the fact that we actually carry an aspect of that, an expression of that within our souls or somewhere within our being that is still slumbering. And the outer encounter of something can awaken and remind us of actually what we carry within us. And it's that resonance that interests me particularly in this theme this evening. I imagine what it must have been like to enter I don't want to keep calling it the First Gaudium. I'm only going to talk about the building that was begun in 1913, and I'll just refer to it as the Gaudium. So I imagine what it must have been like to come up the hill and be confronted with the building if you hadn't seen it in its stages of becoming. A curious building, a curious structure, a striking structure. And if you came in through the west door, you would have been overwhelmed by the wealth of art, architecture, sculpture, painting, light coming through colored glass windows. You would have been overwhelmed by the enormity of the art that this whole building consisted of. And if you already had a connection through a previous incarnation or a pre-birth encounter with Michael and the school of Michael, the encounter with this external, this outward magnificence of impressions would have reminded you, would have awakened in you a memory. Actually, this is something that I know. I've never seen it like this before, but this is familiar to me. Even if I've never seen this before, it speaks of something that resonates in my soul. And what I see here now reminds me and awakens in me actually something that I already have a connection to. If we then go to the Christmas Foundation Conference that, as Andrew said, we can commemorate in a week, happened a year ago, we encounter the Foundation Stone Meditation as it was given over the days during that conference. And the words of the Foundation Stone Meditation may have a similar awakening and reminding quality, but now not in an externally visible dimension, but the words themselves may evoke in us the connections that we already have, but perhaps have not woken up to completely, the connections that we already have to the substance that lives in the words. It is as if the building of the Goetheanum was something that surrounded us outside in this awakening gesture. But now, if we take up the Foundation Stone Meditation, we can experience that the words have this resonating, waking up, reminding quality, but not as something outside and around us, but something that resonates within our consciousness, within our soul, within our mind, and maybe also within our heart. So that the Foundation Stone Meditation can be thought of as a portal, as an instrument that fine-tunes our inner awareness to become conscious of and remember actually a deep connection that we already have, even if we've never experienced it expressed in this way before. And I think in this connection, it's important to stress from the beginning that Rudolf Steiner resisted very much the term temple for the Goetheanum. He never wanted it to be called a temple. It has a sacred quality, certainly, and one feels that there's something that deserves reverence. But it's not an ecclesia. It's not a place where a cult took place. The Goetheanum was an expression of a means by which one could reconnect, or maybe connect for the first time, but reconnect with that which lived most deeply in our biographies and in our souls. An instrument to find our way again in connection with our life of the spirit. Something that made its impression on us from outside. The Foundation Stone Meditation is not a sacred text any more than the Goetheanum was a temple. It's not a holy text that has to be revered and the piece of paper on which we find it written or printed has a kind of sacred quality. It isn't that, at least not for me. I would like to say that the Foundation Stone Meditation is the instrument by means of which, the portal by means of which I can make again, or for the first time, a connection with that which lives most preciously within my longing to become the human being that I am not yet. And in that connection, it's perhaps good to remember that the Foundation Stone Meditation is not the foundation stone. The foundation stone of the Goetheanum was a physical thing, a double dodecahedron of copper that was laid into the ground, and it was a foundation for a building. The foundation stone is not a foundation for a building. It's a foundation for a connection with the refounded Anthroposophical Society. And the Foundation Stone Meditation is an instrument, it's a portal through which that connection can be remembered and strengthened. Rudolf Steiner describes what the Foundation Stone itself is. On the 13th of January in 1924, it was published in the Goetheanum, and I would like to read it. In close connection with the opening meeting was the festival on the morning of the 25th of December, entitled Laying of the Foundation Stone of the General Anthroposophical Society. It could only be a question of laying the foundation stone in an ideal and spiritual sense. The soil in which the stone was laid could be no other than the hearts and souls of those united in the society. And the foundation stone itself must be the attitude of mind which grows when anthroposophy gives shape to life. This attitude in life, required as it is by the signs of the present time, lies in the will to find, by deepening the human soul, the path to an awakened vision of the spirit and to a life proceeding from the spirit. I have to say, I was very glad when I found so clearly expressed that the foundation stone meditation is not the foundation stone. It's a meditation that strengthens our capacity to be true and to awaken to the foundation stone itself. Nevertheless, this evening, I would like to try to show how the foundation stone meditation can be seen to have evolved through an extraordinary metamorphosis from the building, from the Gotianum itself. I used to think that the Christmas Foundation Conference was the significant turning point in Rudolf Steiner's biography and work. I've come to see it a little differently now. I've come to see the whole of the year of 1923 as having that quality of a turning point. It began, of course, with the fire, which was still smoldering on the 1st of January in 1923 that had begun the night before. The whole of that year was a year of grief and pain and extraordinary trials. And the year then culminates in the Christmas Foundation Conference, when the society was refounded, when Rudolf Steiner for the first time became a member of the society, and when the foundation stone meditation was given. And it seems apt to me to think of the paradigm of the mystery of Golgotha in connection with the whole of that year, something of the original Easter Friday mood, lived in the fire, lived in those who witnessed the fire, and indeed lives in those who try to contemplate the significance of that fire. The whole of the year 1923, with all the pain and difficulties and trials and challenges that Rudolf Steiner faced, is so akin for me to the events that we can find described connected with Holy Saturday. And then maybe we're allowed to think of the Christmas Foundation Conference as having something of the resurrection quality of the original Mystery of Golgotha Sunday. And I think at once I need to add then this. The Mystery of Golgotha happened 2,000 years ago, but the significance of it, the fulfillment of it, the real meaning that it may have, lies far in the future and depends actually not on what Christ did and gave us, but on what we do with that. And I hope you'll allow me to suggest that we can think of the Christmas Foundation Conference in that context as well. The conference took place a year ago. Historically, it's something that happened. But I think it's also true to say that the significance, the potential, the true meaning of Rudolf Steiner's deed a year, 100 years ago, the true significance of that is something also that lies in the future and depends now on what we manage to do with what Rudolf Steiner did and what he gave us. Perhaps many of you are familiar with the story that led up to the building of the Gotianum. There was a building in Malsch, there was a room in a building in Stuttgart, there was a plan that there be a building in Munich. At that time it was going to be called Der Johannisbau. It was going to be called the John Building after Johannes Thomasius, a character in the mystery plays that you may well know. And for various reasons, this Munich project was not realized. It came to Rudolf Steiner's attention that a friend, Großheinz, had acquired a hill near Basel in Switzerland, in Dornach. He himself says, "I don't quite know why, but I bought it, not realizing why." So this is one of the beautiful ways in which destiny works. And when it became clear that Munich was not going to happen, Rudolf Steiner gladly accepted the offer to build what was now going to be called the House of the Word in Dornach, on the hill where the Second Goetheanum now stands. Yes, he accepted the offer gladly, but it was also very clear from those who witnessed his demeanor when he first came across this place and contemplated the possibility that something of the tragedies connected with building there had already made themselves in some way known to Rudolf Steiner. But it was clear for him that they would build. And the important thing, as he said at the time, was, "We must build, and we must build soon." So on the 20th of September in 1913, a foundation stone was laid into the ground on the Dornach Hill. There are many wonderful descriptions of this event from people who witnessed it. It was a stormy evening. It was raining, the clouds were billowing, there was a strong wind. It was clear that the elements were participating in many ways in an event. I also found it interesting that as it was dusk and it was getting dark, several braziers were lit around the pit in which the foundation stone was then laid. So the event of the laying of the foundation stone of the Goetheanum was illuminated by living flames in braziers. This is maybe not the occasion to say so much more about the foundation stone itself, except it was a double dodecahedron made of copper, welded together, containing a parchment and some pyrite crystals that were suspended in the two chambers of the welded copper foundation stone. It was laid into the ground, and Rudolf Steiner spoke about the significance of this event. Later that autumn, in October in Oslo, he gave the beginning of a series of lectures that came under the title The Fifth Gospel. And in those lectures, Rudolf Steiner described the experiences of Jesus of Nazareth before the baptism, and also to some extent of Jesus Christ after the baptism. And the descriptions in those lectures, that of course he gave later, help us to understand something of the significance that he spoke of on that 20th of September in 1913. He characterized very clearly and very starkly that the world was in a state of having separated itself somehow from any spiritual culture, that there was a deep hunger and longing amongst people at that time in 1913, at the beginning of that century, there was a deep longing, a thirst and a yearning for the spiritual life that had become very barren and arid at that time. And it becomes clear then when you read the lectures that Rudolf Steiner gave in Oslo in the October series, that this was an experience that Jesus of Nazareth had also had when he was about 24 years old. He had been traveling around Palestine and come across many of the mystery centers that were still operating, but he came to realize that there was a kind of degeneration and, in any case, an inappropriacy anymore for that time for what was offered as a cult in the mystery centers. He realized that the old forms of connection with the spiritual world were either not relevant or appropriate anymore, or indeed had been broken. And then he describes very beautifully how Jesus of Nazareth went to his mother and told her about that. But part of the experience that Jesus of Nazareth had when he realized that the cults and the mystery centers of that time were no longer offering the spiritual nourishment that people yearned for, part of that experience for Jesus of Nazareth was to hear a voice from heaven in which he could hear the disastrous, sad, inadequate situation expressed very powerfully in what has come to be known as the macrocosmic Lord's Prayer. It's a prayer that Jesus of Nazareth heard. He heard it from the heavens, and it was a prayer which lamented the fact that evil was everywhere on hand, that people had separated not only from the gods, but also from each other, imbued, as it were, with guilt around each other, that people no longer remembered the names of the divinities, and that in the daily bread there was nothing but grief. You can find the exact words of this macrocosmic Lord's Prayer in the lecture cycle From Jesus to Christ. And this made a profound effect on Jesus of Nazareth, hearing from the cosmos a confirmation of what he himself perceived, that there had been a terrible separation and a godlessness on earth around him. And after the baptism, when Jesus Christ is now beginning the 3 years of his work, Jesus Christ has a profound experience. And it is, he realizes that it is now not his task to remind people of the voices that they once heard from the spiritual world. It's not his task to bring again that which had flowed from the spiritual world to humanity. But he realized that his task was now to begin something that could be offered from human souls to the cosmos. And it is in that context that Jesus Christ then gives what we know today as the Lord's Prayer. And the Lord's Prayer, Our Father who art in heaven, the Lord's Prayer is a wonderful metamorphosis of the macrocosmic Lord's Prayer that Jesus of Nazareth had heard when he was 24. And now, after the baptism, Jesus Christ is able to transform into a prayer that Christ invites us to engage in, to pray, if we want to speak to the Father. It's a prayer that is addressed to the Father, Our Father who art in heaven. And Rudolf Steiner spoke the powerful words of the macrocosmic Lord's Prayer, and I think it's right to assume that probably nobody there knew that he was going to say anything like that, and when they heard it, I don't think they knew what it was. Already on that 20th of September 1913, he spoke about the four Gospels and the need for there to be a fifth one. And he spoke about the macrocosmic Lord's Prayer in that context. But it's also clear from the people who were there that they didn't entirely expect on that occasion what he was going to say. And we are told that when somebody realized exactly how significant all these events and these what Rudolf Steiner was saying was, that he hurriedly began to write down what he heard, leaning on the back of a good friend who offered his back as a sort of firm basis on which he could write. So it was a powerful experience that was unexpected in a way. And I wanted to take the trouble to say it all in this much detail, because what we can discern from all this is Rudolf Steiner wanted to affirm the thirst, the longing for true spiritual life in the world, and the fact that there was a dearth of that, that the spiritual life was not nourishing. And he wanted to remember the experience that Jesus of Nazareth had had in the laying of the foundation stone for the Gertianum, because it was his longing, his intention, that the building that would be constructed would then be a source for a renewal of the life of the Spirit for people on earth. And it was in recognition of what the Gertianum would become that he began by describing in this dramatic way exactly the circumstances on earth out of which the longing for precisely what could then flow from the Gertianum would be available. I think many of you will be familiar with pictures of the Gertianum. It was a double-domed building. It has to be said that the building in Munich had also been planned as a double-domed building, but it had never been built. So what was built in Dornach as a double-domed building was a first, and it was an architectural challenge. Rudolf Steiner was not a trained architect. He was convinced that it was possible, and he persuaded the architects concerned to find a way in which it would be possible to construct a building that was made of two domes that intersected, a smaller dome that would be then over the stage, and the larger dome that would then be the auditorium. Rudolf Steiner had intended to build in concrete, but the members prevailed on him and said, oh no, why don't we build it in wood? So the building had a concrete base, the building then itself and the whole of the architectural inside was built of wood, and it was covered with a slate roof. It took about 10 years to build. At the same time as the building was being constructed, Rudolf Steiner was working with the English sculptor Edith Marion on a representation of the representative of humanity as he walks forward, as he strides forward, holding the balance between those forces that want to deflect him one way or another. So again, I think many of you will be familiar with this wooden sculpture known as the representative of humanity, the Christ being between the figures of Lucifer and Ahriman. This sculpture was conceived within the womb of the building of the Gertianum, but in a sense, it was an ectopic pregnancy. Because although it was very clear from the beginning that this sculpture would have the significant place at the east end of the stage, at the back of the stage, the sculpture was conceived to be placed there, and the architecture of the building was conceived with the understanding that this sculpture of the representative of humanity would be, in a way, the crowning glory of the small dome, and indeed of the small space, the stage space, and indeed of the whole building. And it is quite an extraordinary thing that this sculpture never found its way into the building. There was a time around about 1920 when some of the workers asked Edith Marion particularly, but I think also Rudolf Steiner, well, our building is not yet finished and your sculpture is not yet finished, but why don't you bring the unfinished sculpture into the unfinished building and we can all complete this work together? Because after all, is the sculpture not intended to be in the building? And I think it was Edith Marion who responded to the request from the workers, and she gently suggested that this was not the right time for that. But I think you will know that on the on New Year's Eve of 1922, the still almost finished but not yet consecrated building was destroyed by fire. The sculpture had not been placed in the building and therefore was saved. It was in the carpenter's workshop a little further up the hill. There is a very profound consequence of that. If you go to Dornach and you see the sculpture of the representative of humanity, you may have all sorts of questions about where it is now housed and how one can visit it. But however it could ever be housed, it will always be homeless. It's a powerful experience when you live with that, that wherever this is now put, it will not be in the place it was intended to be in, even if one may think it should be intended to, it was intended then to be at the back of the building that is now there. This is another topic, but the point I wish to make is that the experience that surrounds this sculpture is that it is, in a physical sense, homeless, because the place that it was intended to be, and I want to repeat the image, the womb in which it was conceived, but in which it never found itself, has been destroyed, and therefore it will always have this quality of homelessness in a physical sense. And for me, that becomes a challenge. Can one give it a home in another way and not just lament where it cannot be, but be busy with where it can be in the work one does with it and for it and around it? Well, the Goetheanum was destroyed in the fire that burnt on the night of the 31st of December in 1922. It was completely destroyed, apart, of course, from the concrete base. And there are several stories of people close to Rudolf Steiner who had intimations that the building would be destroyed. Two people particularly had a dream in which the Goetheanum was seen to burn. And they went to Rudolf Steiner and said, "We dreamt that the Goetheanum would burn." And this was long before the fire itself. And his response was, "Yes, I know. Please don't speak about this to others." And maybe the question then arises, if Rudolf Steiner knew that the building would burn, why did he not do something to prevent that? Why did he not do more to prevent that? Why did he continue to build in wood? Why were not more fire precautions taken? And it's a theme that I think belongs to our topic this evening, because I would like to try and explain it, to describe it in this way. One could say that the content of occult science came to artistic expression in the Goetheanum through architecture, sculpture, painting, and the colored glass windows. All of those plastic arts were part of the building. And if you imagine then that on the stage there might be the spoken word, there might be a concert, there might be drama, there would be eurythmy, there would be the mystery dramas. And in the whole experience of this building, the seventh art would also be a potential, the social art. So this building of architecture, sculpture, and painting, in which then the performing arts of eurythmy, of drama, a spoken lecture, and the social art could all be practiced together. This building was an integral artistic expression of anthroposophy. And that is something quite profound, that there would be a complete artistic expression of the content of anthroposophy as art. And the significance of these are these spiritual impulses incarnating into the plastic and performing arts. the spiritual significance of the fact that this happened does not depend on how long the building then endures. This may be a hard thing for you to hear. It's not an easy thing to say. But if you follow me, perhaps you can understand that nothing on earth will last forever anyway. The significance of what incarnates does not depend on how long it lives, but on the fact that the mineral substances have borne the traces of the spiritual creative act undertaken by human beings. So think of the concrete, the wood, the glass, the slate, the people who worked there. Everything was transformed. The mineral substances were transformed by the fact that people incarnated into this mineral substance, the inspirations that they have out of the spiritual world of the art that expressed anthroposophy. That is the significant thing. Of course, the longer it lasts, the more people can be nourished by it, enjoy it, wonder at it, contemplate it, deepen their relationship to it. Of course, of course. But the prime significance of such an artistic reality is that it come to being, that something that is spiritually inspired through the work of people who serve that comes to expression then through the mineral realm. The mineral realm is in itself transformed by that. And again, I wanted to make much of this point because we can say that the Goetheanum was lost. It's interesting. At the Christmas Foundation conference, when somebody said, we've lost the Goetheanum, Rudolf Steiner immediately said, no, we've lost the building. We haven't lost the Goetheanum. It's perfectly true that in the following months, he several times did say in lectures, we have lost the Goetheanum. But immediately in the conference of 1923, his response was, no, the Goetheanum has not been lost. What has been lost is the building. And what I would like to try to develop now is a description of how that which lived in the Goetheanum, in the sense perceptible mineral realm as an artistic reality, then became something that now lives in the foundation stone meditation, so that I can justify the title this evening, The House of the Word Becomes the Word. The large auditorium was surrounded by 2x7 pillars that represented the planetary epochs. And the stage itself was supported by 12 pillars that represented the zodiac. Each of the pillars was made of a particular timber that connected and represent that was connected to the planets in question. And the architraves had a most beautiful moving motif, so that if you came into the auditorium, if you came into the hall of the building, the experience would be of movement, of time, of process. But I would like to take you into an imagination in the following way. Imagine the Goetheanum there on the hill. Maybe you're coming to an evening event, a lecture or a eurythmic performance or whatever. And you come up the hill from your daily work, either from your home, your family, or your colleagues at work, and you bring with you as you come up the hill the residue of the day as it lives in your soul, as it lives in your memory, as it lives in your thoughts. So you bring the rest of the day with you as you come into the building. And maybe you come in through the west door and you come up the staircase. And on the way in, No doubt you encounter many people that you know. Some you are maybe glad to see and greet in a friendly way. Some people you may not be that particularly glad to see, and maybe you nod cursorily or even maybe even ignore them as you come in. I think this prevalent social reality is something one can acknowledge. You come into the building and you are surrounded at once by these sculptured and architectural forms that remind you, as I already indicated at the beginning, remind you of our unfinished human evolution. There's such an invitation in the whole of the visible experience of the remembering of our journey, of our unfinished journey, where we have been and where we are going. And your limbs carry you into this building. And the first experience of that might well have been, gosh, this is like the womb out of which I know I have been born. I have been born out of this divine cosmic reality that now surrounds me in the architecture, the sculpture, and the painting on the ceilings, and maybe something of the light still comes through the windows. And if I then take my place in the auditorium, I have become still, but the movement in the architecture and in the sculpture and in the painting, the movement that I'm surrounded by in the art, carries my attention forwards towards the stage. And whatever it is that I've come for that evening then unfolds in time on the stage in front of me, whether it's a lecture or a performance or a concert. So I experience the space in which my limbs have carried me, into which my limbs have carried me, and I experience the time that is expressed spatially, and then I experience the real time of what it is that I am shown, what I've come to witness and observe on the stage. And whatever it is that is happening on the stage, it happens in front of course, this never happened, but ideally, it would take place in front of the sculpture of the representative of humanity, who's not hanging on a cross, who's not standing in an Orantes gesture, but who is striding forward in the active engagement with those forces that have the task to challenge our progress so that our progress can become the stronger. So whatever it is that I see taking place on the stage, I see in the context of the greater meaning that all our human striving has in the light of the mystery of Golgotha. And in my heart and in my soul and in my breathing as I sit there, there is this longing to make sense of what it is that I'm experiencing, spatially, but also in time, and also whatever it is that is being performed or offered. There is this longing to make sense of what it is that I'm witnessing. And then gradually, the experience of space that I'm in, that my limbs have brought me into, and my experience of what lives in time as whatever it is that I'm watching unfolds and reveals itself, that both this spatial and temporal reality then give way to another dimension of consciousness. I can begin to think beyond the space and beyond the time that I am in. I can begin to think and allow my receptive thinking to be blessed by something that comes from the spiritual world and endows my experience with meaning. And at such moments, I feel entirely free. Remember the beautiful description in chapter 9 of the Philosophy of Freedom, where Rudolf Steiner describes that we're actually freedom. He's not interested in freedom of choice there. We can do whatever we like. The freedom that he's talking about there is nothing impedes you from a direct connection with your deepest destiny intentions. You are free when you do that which lives as your deepest, highest, noblest, most human intentions. So that freedom there is a freedom from anything that interferes in your connection, you could say, with your own destiny, with your angel, with your karma, with the spiritual dimension of the situation you are in. And it may well be that at such moments, sitting in the space and experiencing the time, that intuitive grasp of what it means and what it then fires your will to do becomes part of the experience in the house of the word. And when the performance is over, you get up. And if you've come in by the west entrance, you've been facing the east, the stage. If you come in, and coming in, you haven't had to turn around. You come in, you face the stage, and you take your place. You've never needed to turn around. You might have turned around, but you haven't needed to. But in order to go out now, you have to turn around. You wouldn't walk backwards through the door you came in. And I'm interested in this turning. You've been sitting, and you stand up, and you now turn. You turn and you face the west entrance that you came in. I know there were other entrances and exits. You might have taken a lateral entrance and a lateral exit. But for the purposes of this imagination, please allow me to continue on the assumption that you came in through the west door and now you want to leave through the west door. So you stand up and you turn round. A small physical gesture, a small bodily reality. But I want to suggest it's not that small, because in that turning round and getting ready to leave, behind you now, there is this figure of the representative of humanity. Behind you, what is the right word now? Impelling is the wrong word. Inspiring is the wrong word. Living, that's also the wrong word. What can we say? Behind you is an image of the human being that we are not yet, progressing forwards as a reminder, as an invitation, as an encouragement to leave with the consciousness of that which I have seen and participated in, and that immense goodness and love behind me as I now leave. And now as you leave, you again encounter all the people, or some of them, that you met coming in. And if it's been a significant experience for the last hour or two, if you realize that together with these, at least for the last couple of hours, destiny companions of yours, if it's been a significant experience, then maybe there is a different quality to the acknowledgement that you offer them as you leave. They may be people that you know and like, and there may be people that you have difficulty with. But if you take seriously the fact that for the last couple of hours, you've shared the opportunity to engage in the same spiritual substance, however differently you may be doing so, maybe you're inclined to greet those people whom you were not so happy to greet at the beginning, now with a different acknowledgement of having been sisters and brothers together in this shared event. And you now go out into the world and back to your home, or wherever it is that you're going to. And I wanted to characterize that imagination in this way, because if you're familiar with the Foundation Stone meditation, maybe you will recognize that many of the gestures that I tried to describe in connection with an imagined experience in the building are actually given to us again in the imaginations of the Foundation Stone meditation. We're asked to recognize that our limbs bring us into a space, and we are encouraged to remember. We're encouraged also to practice spirit sensing. I really like that translation, Übergeist besinnen. There are other translations, but the beauty of the word sensing, like the word besinnen in German, carries both the meaning of having an impression, a sense impression, Sinn, and also the meaning, because it's also a beautiful aspect of Rudolf Steiner's philosophy of freedom, that we never have a sense impression without longing to know what it means. They're two sides of the same coin. So if we talk about practice spirit sensing, it's to make sense of what our senses mediate to us. And that is a process that takes place in time, that is connected with the beat of heart and lung as we participate, not passively, but receptively, in whatever it is that is shown to us there. And the practice spirit remembering is very much a spatial experience that takes place in the realm of the Father God, the space. The making sense is a process that lives in time. And time is the dimension where the Son God, where Christ reigns. And the third part of the foundation stone meditation that can be characterized with this invitation to practice spirit beholding is then not necessarily just the beholding of what is sense perceptible, but Übergeist erschauen. The air is beautiful because it gives this energy into the looking. And it's not a receptive looking, it's an active looking. And it has to do with this capacity to open the inner organs of perception so that that which is ready to come and endow your understanding with what comes from the spiritual world can be received. But it doesn't stop there, because in that third part, what we are given, the verb in German is schenken, what we are given is something that we take through a metamorphic process and then offer up. And now the verb is not schenken, but it's erbitten. We are asking to be able to give something that comes as a result of that active, receptive, receptive, active dynamic that we experience through the thinking. And the fourth part of the foundation stone meditation begins with at the turning point of time. You remember that the Genesis begins with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The opening of the John Gospel is, in the beginning was the Word. The fourth part of the foundation stone meditation begins at the turning point of time. And somehow I'm always teased by that, to think, do I actually know any beginnings and ends that are not really turning points? And this turning point of time in the fourth part is an invitation, first of all, to remember what happened at the mystery of Golgotha. The shepherds and the kings are specifically mentioned, so we think of the Christmas and the Bethlehem events. But interestingly enough, and I'm sure many of you will know this well, the verbs are in the present tense. So light that warms the hearts of simple shepherds, not warmed, light that illumines, not illuminated, the heads of wise kings. And Rudolf Steiner was very aware when he gave this foundation stone meditation in the Christmas conference 1923-24, that among those who were there were, of course, representatives of those two streams of our human evolution, now present at this turning point in the conscious spiritual life of those who'd found their way to anthroposophy. this moment, this turning point moment in the founding of the refounding of the society and Rudolf Steiner joining it for the first time, he was very conscious that amongst those present were those who represented the two streams that can also be characterized as the kings and the shepherds. And it was Rudolf Steiner's most earnest wish that the members who were there would recognize this as a more than an invitation, a plea, a longing, that those people who came from different karmic streams would begin to work together and recognize each other and be willing to acknowledge each other without necessarily agreeing, but certainly being able to work together. And it is for the first time in the Foundation Stone Meditation at the end that what everywhere else has been you becomes we, that good may become what we would found. Andrew, are you there?
Of course, I'm here.
I'm asking for guidance about time.
You're doing fine. I think normally we leave about 15 to 20 minutes for Q&A, which we might just skip that.
It's an open question. I mean, I realize I've been going for an hour now, and I want to know how much more you can bear.
Well, Andrew, I'm your friend, so you can keep going.
Okay.
I love this. So, we do want to stop, though, in about 10 more minutes.
Okay. Well, I think it's nice if people have the chance to respond with comments or questions, though I don't necessarily presume to be able to answer them. But you can imagine I've chosen to say a few things in an hour, and there would be so much more to say. And I hope you will excuse me for not having shown you any images. I maybe foolishly wanted to rely on being able to evoke the appropriate images through the way I spoke. Maybe just one final set of connections. In the macrocosmic Lord's Prayer, Jesus of Nazareth hears the voice speaking out of the cosmos. Rudolf Steiner gives it a name. He calls it the Bath Call, the voice of the daughters. In the Lord's Prayer, Christ invites us to address the Father. So Jesus of Nazareth hears the voice out of the cosmos. Then Jesus Christ transforms that into the voice of the individual who addresses the Father. In the Gertianum, the Christ was present, of course, in many ways, but visibly in the sculpture of the represented of humanity. And in the Foundation Stone Meditation, Christ takes the central place in the second of the three first parts of the meditation. And in the Foundation Stone Meditation, Rudolf Steiner transforms the well-known Rosicrucian sayings of ex Deo nascimur, in Christo morimur, per spiritum sanctum reviviscimus. He speaks them in this Latin way on the 25th of December and on the other days. But later, when he publishes the Foundation Stone Meditation, he doesn't use those Latin Rosicrucian sayings. He doesn't translate them. Then it goes through a metamorphosis, and he speaks in German sentences that evoke that content, but in a very different way, grammatically and contextually. In the Latin, it's always we are born, we die, we are revived. In the German that Rudolf Steiner then uses, it's described as an objective thing that happens to us. And you may also know that the way in which he gave the Foundation Stone meditation on the 25th of December, and then in the following days, again through their rhythms, he changes the words sometimes. And the way in which the Foundation Stone meditation has come down to us is also full of uncertainties about what are the right words, what are the correct words, which is the right way of saying this for a eurythmic performance or as an individual meditation. And I find it so beautiful that there's no answer to that. That's such an expression of not just freedom, but trust in freedom. Because if you find your own relationship to the Foundation Stone meditation, and you engage with it earnestly, meditatively, whatever version you use will be an expression of something to do with how you encountered it or your own biography. But whatever that may be, the earnest engagement with this portal, with this instrument, will lead you to whatever your relationship with the content is. So again, just to rehearse the point that I made at the beginning, the Goetheanum was not a temple. It was an instrument by means of which a connection could either be newly made or renewed. A connection with the spiritual world out of which we come and with which we have an inalienable connection. And in the same way, the Foundation Stone meditation is not the Foundation Stone, but it's an instrument by means of which we can develop, strengthen, renew, remember, affirm what Rudolf Steiner calls an attitude to the whole of life that is permeated by anthroposophy. And I find it very beautiful that the significance of the building did not depend on its enduring physically. Sad and tragic, though that certainly was, I in no way wish to minimize the significance and the tragedy of the fire, but it would be a greater tragedy if that was the only aspect that we focused on. And similarly for the Foundation Stone meditation, it is a means by which we can find a relationship to anthroposophy. It is not, the Foundation Stone meditation is not the source of that activity. It's the guide to that activity. It's the portal. It's the instrument by which our connection to the imperishable spiritual substance can be found, refound, strengthened, celebrated, and lived. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. Thank you so much. We share our names, but and I think we share an awful lot of what you brought too. I think we can take, or although I almost feel like we shouldn't take any questions, just leave it at this. But if anybody feels very strongly that they have some question that they want to ask, I think we can take that at this moment. And to do that, on the bottom, there's a icon, raise hand. And if you click that, I can recognize you. But yeah, Andrew, this has been quite a special hour that we got to share with you. And yeah, and others are also expressing their gratitude. So yeah, as we come up to this 100th commemoration, there's so much one can do in preparation by taking up this Foundation Stone meditation and working with it between now and then, and hopefully a lot. So, yeah, thank you all for your comments coming in. You know, Andrew, you've spoken to us from your heart like a Renaissance artist. And I'm very happy we got to share this hour with you. So it's your evening. Let me just see what happened in the Q&A here. Somebody asked, could you say anything more about the three sisters?
The three sisters?
That's what they wrote.
I don't think I spoke about three sisters.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the question refers to, but it's important for me to affirm again and again that there is a sisterly and brotherly relationship as between us. And maybe that was, I didn't articulate that clearly enough. Is that the only question?
Yes, I think so. Our comments, that people are expressing their gratitude to what you were able to bring. So, well, I will let you get back to your evening, and I wish everyone just wonderful Third Advent tomorrow and all the preparations that you may be undertaking for Christmas and for the Christmas conference commemoration. So thank you all for participating. And good night to you, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Andrew. And thank you all for attending to this. And I hope it may lead to something fruitful in your inner life in relationship to these phenomena.
Thank you. Bye now.
Thank you, Andrew.